The following presentation was recorded during Teachers Week at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
And for the next few minutes, I'll wait till we have some more seated here. All right, for the next 4 minutes, I'd like for you to take this map and just label the map, anything you know on it. Rivers, mountains, nations, cities, anything that you know the location of, just label it on the map, please. Geographic regions, deserts, plateaus, whatever. So, for the next 4 minutes, go ahead and see how much of the map you can fill in. This afternoon, help us to look beyond the temporal, help us to look to eternity, and help us to look ahead, and help us to live our lives so that they would bring honor and glory to you. We pray that this topic this afternoon might bring honor and glory to your name. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. Okay, I'm going to possibly begin with the drawing this afternoon. We'll start out with this. What do you see?
Three dots.
Okay, what else? What are some other ways to describe what you see?
Triangle.
Triangle?
Two eyes and a mouth.
Two eyes and a mouth? What else? Thank you. A businessman once hung up a large sheet of paper, put one dot on it, went around the room, and wondered what each one saw, and each one saw a dot in the middle of the paper. But you folks were missing the bigger picture. You were missing the broader picture, some of you. And that's what I want to focus on today, the broader picture. Why study history? And when we think about history, we don't want to become... We sometimes get caught up in the facts, the dates, the places, the people, you know, the facts. And we forget the broader picture. So, what is the broader picture? What is the broad picture? If you go to your, I have an outline today. We have some verses at the top. The first thing, the real broad picture is, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the holy is understanding. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Without the fear of the Lord, we might as well not be here. Without the fear of the Lord, you might as well not teach history class when you go back home. Now, next question is, what is the fear of the Lord? How would you describe? What is the fear of the Lord? This needs to be our foundation for, I would say, any subject we teach. And I know that it's possibly a bit more difficult to incorporate into mathematics than it is into social studies. But nevertheless, this needs to be our foundation for teaching anything in school. What is the fear of the Lord? Well, two words that I thought about this is reverential awe. Standing in awe and reverence. We see God, how great He is, we stand in reverence and awe of Him. And I see this area of reverential awe as an area where we need a lot of growth in. As I look across conservative churches, I think we need a lot of growth in this area of reverential awe. Now, we're going to talk about some of this. You may wonder how it relates to history, but hopefully we'll bring it all together. George W. Bush, governor of Texas, presidential candidate, One of his famous statements says he wants to restore integrity to the White House. Now, aside from all the moral scandals of the past year or 2 years, what does he mean by that? Restore integrity to the White House. You may not be aware of it, but there's a lot of politicians out there that are concerned or have a big problem with Mr. Clinton, the way he comes to work, the way he's appeared when he comes to the way he appears, or the way he's attired when he comes to his office. What do you expect of a president of any business, of a bank, or the president of the United States? How would you expect him to appear if he walked in here this afternoon?
Suit, coat, and a tie.
And this is conservatives, by the way, that usually have a problem with this, but they don't appreciate him coming to his office with his casual wear on. Are these politicians right in feeling that way? What do you think? I feel that way. I'm conservative. You can find that out. But the fear of the Lord affects our approach to our affects our approach to life. It affects our approach to God, and it affects our approach to worship. And the thing that I see among us sometimes, we have sometimes the conservative ministers that want to try and get our people to keep on dressing up for worship. And I appreciate that. And, you know, the political leaders of our land have a sense of there's a respectable way to appear. There's a respectable way to conduct yourself. The way we approach our responsibility, that's where what the concern is about. A respectable way to approach responsibility. You know, the reason we face this, the world is about us is so casual. They take a casual approach to worship. They take a casual approach to God. They take a casual approach to their responsibility. And I'm convinced that we can't really develop the fear of the Lord if we're going to take a casual approach to life. And if your students see that you're taking a casual approach towards life, I don't think they're going to as readily develop the fear of the Lord. The fear of the Lord affects our speech. We're trying to decide what we're trying to define the fear of the Lord. What is the fear of the Lord? It's that reverential awe of God that guards our lips, that guards our tongue. Let me back up just a bit. It guards our tongue, especially when we are facing or talking to antagonists, someone that's antagonistic. I was impressed recently. I was teaching a Bible class to some city children, and there was another brother or two sitting in the class. And afterwards, some two brothers were talking about the class, and I came up and asked the one brother if he would critique the way I handled the lesson. And I was shocked with what he said. I was expecting, come on, you can critique something here. But he said, I can't do that unless I spend some time in prayer first. You know, my tendency is I'm ready to give you some criticism whether you ask for it or not. He's saying, I need to talk to God before I criticize you. And that's what the fear of the Lord will do. I see that man who possesses the fear of the Lord. It affects the amount of time that we spend in developing a relationship with God. The fear of the Lord affects the quality of the time that I spend building my relationship with God. The fear of the Lord affects the way I relate to my brothers and sisters. my students. The fear of the Lord affects our lifestyle, the way we use our money, or the way we complain about our lack of money. These things come into focus when we think of the fear of the Lord. Now, I was looking at some of these things, and I said I'm conservative, and you may beginning to think I'm a legalist, which I'm not. There's not enough. You cannot impose enough rules on your class, in your classroom, or on your students to bring forth the fear of the Lord. It's impossible. But nevertheless, none of us here would want to disregard rules in our classroom. So there is a way where we need to instill in the children the fear of the Lord. One of the biggest things is example. I mean, what they see coming forth from your life. And then we're going to look at some of this in connection with teaching history. For I determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. That was Paul's vision. He wanted these people, and if we look at the context of this verse, he was looking at education, the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. And in that context, he says, my desire for you was that you know Christ and Him crucified. So, my desire is this afternoon that we can let these verses overshadow our discussion this afternoon. Okay, first of all, I want to give credit to some teachers that I've contacted to kind of help me with this subject. They're not all my ideas. And we'll talk about a lot of ideas. I tend to be an idealist. And when you teach, say, four grades, all the subjects in conventional classroom, I tend to be a frustrated idealist. And you will be too if you're an idealist and you're teaching those grades. So, we're going to talk about a lot of things. I don't expect you to go home and go, wow, this is just too much. I don't expect you to do everything we talk about this afternoon, but hopefully you can pick up on something this afternoon that you can take home and apply in your setting. One more thing, how many of you teach in individualized classrooms? Okay, there's several. I apologize to you, I only thought of it last night, that I'm gearing this solely towards conventional. I went through conventional school, I taught in conventional school, and just yesterday I thought, well, there are some folks who use individualized curriculum. So hopefully you can gain some things that you can use as well. I'm not familiar with the individualized curriculum, so hopefully there's something you can apply in your settings. Okay, let's just take a look at the outline quickly. These questions are questions that I came up. They were intended to guide my thinking. We may not necessarily answer each question specifically, but hopefully for each section we can have an understanding of the section by the time we're through. So I'm not exactly sure how all of this will fit together yet, but we'll see what we can do. All right, why did I have you fill out a map if this is history class? So that enters into my definition of history. What is history? Well, history is, as far as I'm concerned, is made up of three integral parts. And we'll look at these parts. First of all, history itself. What is history itself? Well, it's a study of time. It's a study of events. It's the study of people. But to me, these things are quite meaningless if you don't study about the where of the place. And that brings us to geography. Geography is a study of the place. And they're quite inseparable as far as I'm concerned. Geography and history. In order to have a good history class, geography and history are inseparable. And the books I've taught generally have had a good mix of geography and history. I am familiar with some books that don't do very well in bringing in geography. And there are reproducible maps out there that are available. If your books don't bring in geography, by all means, bring it in. Okay, so we're studying time, we're studying place, and we're also studying about people and how they related to each other, social studies. The way man relates to his fellow man, conflict, harmony, etc. So, what is history? In a few words, I would say history is a story of God dealing with his creation, and we are part of that creation, God dealing with man. It's a story of man's response to God, or the story of man's response to his knowledge of God, or lack of knowledge to God. So that explains my approach in this subject. We're going to be looking at history. We're going to look at geography and social studies. Some of you in your classes, you'll be teaching social studies rather than history. To me, it's all one and the same thing. I mean, it's not technically, but they're basically inseparable. I might insert here, as far as the one question here, I think, asks, what subject matter can I expect to encounter in teaching my history class? One thing, well, how many of you are using Abeka books? Okay, well, you will encounter patriotism. You probably have noticed that already. Will you encounter exaltation of heroes? And I just insert this now, that way maybe I'll remember to talk about it a little later in addressing some of those issues. All right, why teach history? The purpose. Well, the reasons can be as varied as probably as many students as we have sitting here. But just a few, grades 7 and 8, you might teach them history so that they have a reason to take a nap right after lunch. But hopefully this class this afternoon might help, and they won't need to take a nap after lunch. We want to try and guard against the type of students who will write in their textbook, in case of fire, throw this in. But I asked one teacher why I teach history. He said, well, 7th and 8th graders, so they have reason to nap after lunch. Well, that may have been a reflection on the teacher as well. Grades 4 to 6, it's interesting. And grades 1 to 3, they love it. Those are some reasons. All right, maybe some more fundamental reasons. History is a story of God's workings. We study God's commands. We study God's character. We study God's salvation. Why not study his workings? His works shed light on who he is. His works shed light on his salvation, on his character, and on his commands. We also want to learn the lessons of the past. Knowledge to avoid making the same mistakes that were made in the past. And I say experience is not the best teacher, especially as it relates to building character. We want to learn what brought the world to the place where we are today. Why do we have the freedoms that we have? Why do we experience these freedoms? Why do we have such a moral decline in our nation? Why? What's the reasons for our present economic boom? What brought the world to the place where we are today? We want to increase our world awareness. We conservative, Mennonite, Anabaptist people tend to be rather narrow-minded at times. We want our children to be able to know that life exists beyond Lancaster County or beyond Holmes County or beyond Waynes County. There's more to life. There's more. The world exists just more than where I live. We want them to learn to understand that there are different ways of living around the world, and also that our grandparents did not live the way that we do. One of my main goals in teaching history is to foster missionary interests. And you can become unbalanced in this, but I don't think you can in history class. I mean, the history class is a good class where you can focus on that. And then in other classes, you can focus on more domestic issues. But in history class, good time to focus on missionary interests, focus on local or missions at home, missions abroad. Okay, another reason that I believe is important to learn history is because society is learning it. Those around us are learning it. I am convinced that, or I feel very strongly that we need to be a competent people. Our children need to be competent. And especially so, being some of our schools, you go through 8th grade and you're done, or you go through 10th grade and you're done. We want them to be competent when they're out of school. We want them to be able to communicate what's the importance of history. Well, did you ever notice it? You may have noticed it here. That it's not that difficult to strike up a conversation with folks here. I mean, teachers. You have something in common. And if we know the same things, we kind of share experiences. So the importance of studying history is what others are studying. We know some of the things that others know. And it provides it enables us to communicate, not just with history, but other subjects as well, because others are studying it. We need to be able to learn to communicate. We want to develop some concepts of time, concepts of space. And it's interesting, especially for grades 1 and 2, it's more fun for grades 1 and 2. It's not as intense. It's not an intense subject. It kind of gives them a break from the routine. All right, the content. What should we expect elementary students to learn? Let's hear from you. Let me find something here first. How many of you are first year teachers? I mean, this coming year will be your first year. Okay, most of you have taught before. What should we expect elementary students to learn? First and second grades, what should they learn? What are some things that you feel are important for first and second grade, for a student to know by the time they leave second grade? Location of continents and oceans, good.
Where they live?
What country and what state? Good. I never taught grades 1 and 2, and that's why I'm not real... I'm not real as versed in this as I ought to be. Well, I think probably a sense of time, the difference between AD and BC, that comes fairly natural with understanding the Bible, New Testament, and Old Testament. Establishing the beginning of history, which from our settings, that should already be established before they ever come to school, but you want that reinforced. Holidays, what are the different holidays? Thanksgiving, they should kind of know the Thanksgiving story of the pilgrims, and Christmas, Easter, what, be able to associate the stories with the holidays. How about grade 4? By the time they leave grade 4, what should they be able to master? Okay, longitude, latitude, the immigrants. How people live in different communities helps to broaden their horizons a little bit, to know that not everybody eats the same things that I eat. And we'll look at some of the methods here, but we can insert some here. But it's good to show them pictures, or you know, show them pictures of different foods that they can eat. That I think they should probably be able to categorize some of the important events as AD or BC. Landforms, at least being introduced to landforms, knowing the difference between a peninsula and an isthmus. All right, grades 5 and 6. Maybe I should say this. These grades may or may not be necessarily be important. I just tried to sketch something out here to give us a little guideline. By the time they leave grade 6, so they should have the basic history of their own nation. Landforms should be down pat. They should know what a continent is, what a islands, isthmuses, straits, difference between a strait and a channel. States and capitals. They should be knowledgeable with maps as well. Know how to read a map, know how to use maps. So by the time they leave grade 8, what we really want to accomplish here, by the time they're ready to enter high school or leave grade 8, they should have a strong sense of time, time frame, dates. They should have captured the characters of prominent men, and some of that was done already back in third and fourth grade, but capture the characters of prominent men. What made them famous? George Washington, Abe Lincoln. What were their strengths? What were their weaknesses? They should have the landforms mastered, know the different regions of the world, and they should have an ability to read and work maps, and also an ability to locate ancient empires on maps. So these are some of the different ideas that other teachers have been giving me, as well as some of my own.
Would that last in 7th and 8th grade?
Yes. By the time they... You mean the last one I mentioned on empires?
Yeah.
Yeah, they should be able to, by the time they leave 8th grade, they should probably know some of the ancient empires, where they were located on the maps. Okay, what are you going to use? What for material? Well, you first-year teachers, be sure to know your text, first of all. That's going to be your main source. Be familiar with your text. And if you're teaching 4 grades and all the subjects in 4 grades, I know it's going to be difficult, but try to stay ahead of your students. Don't get behind the students. Don't assign them work for the next day that you haven't even read yourself. Or if you do that, be sure you read it until you come to class. And I know it happens. It happens. I'm not. It's happened to me already, and it's an awkward position. It's better to say we'll skip class today rather than to get yourself into a class that you know nothing about. That's my opinion. So master the textbook. And most teachers in the first year already too should be making use of encyclopedias, and the children should know that you're making use of encyclopedias. Find out some of the stories, the background of the material, because a lot of your texts don't have a lot of specifics that will interest his children. Pick up and read different copies of, maybe this would come later, once you've been teaching 3 or 4 years, you'll have time to pick up some copies of other publishers and read their viewpoint, read their philosophy. And that's especially true, I think, if you're teaching from some of these fundamentalist books. I'm not familiar with Bob Jones, not very familiar, but Becca especially. Pick up some other books, secular books, as well as some that are put out like by Christian Light and Rod and Staff. I understand that Rod and Staff has a good book coming out that will at least help you to balance some of the issues that are being taught in your history books if you're using a fundamentalist book. And I'm assuming that probably any books put out, maybe I shouldn't assume before I see them, but I'm assuming that any books put out by conservative Mennonites will be somewhat biased as well. So you need to remember that the textbook you're using is going to be somewhat biased. They're trying to influence your attitude about history. They're trying to influence your attitude towards war, towards characters. That's their purpose. So keep that in mind. What is the emphasis? What's behind the book that you're using, the text that you're using? And, of course, make use of a public library. And there could be others. Maybe you have some other resources you feel should be used. Okay. It's almost time for a break as far as where we got on our material. But before we go for a break, let us first of all consider a question. What subject matter do young children seem to especially like in history? Stories? Okay.
I was
missionary stories. Good. What else? Really stands out. Oftentimes, children like to maybe play the historical events. What else?
Pilgrims and Indians.
Okay, what I had in mind was Indians. Indian history, Indian culture seems to fascinate, I've found it in my experience, seems to fascinate young children. Right in this area was a considerable population of Seneca Indians back in the 1700s. Right here in this area, Crawford County, was good hunting grounds for the Indians. There was lots of game, lots of streams with fresh water, lots of fish, lots of game for the Indians to live off of. So right here, we're in somewhat one of their prime hunting grounds. Some of you are familiar with the area. The stream right down behind us here runs into the French Creek, and there were some rude dwellings along the French Creek. Do any of you know where the Mercer Street Bridge is in Meadville? Okay, that's fine. I don't know either. I just thought maybe some of you are more familiar with the area than I am. But right in that area, which is just west of here, lived Chief White, Chief Stripe Neck. Now, the Indians here in this time were mostly friendly towards whites. There were some white captives that they had, but they were mostly friendly. And Chief Striped Neck was an old chief, and when he died, the white men helped to bury him. And that was an act of goodwill, and it established a sense of goodwill between the Indians and the whites. However, as time moved on, more and more settlers kept moving into the area, and it seems that quite possibly they felt threatened by all these white settlers coming into their hunting grounds, and relations kind of cooled off somewhat. But at any rate, one of the first settlers in this township here was a man by the name of James Brawley. He came here in 1795. Relationships at this time with the Indians were quite friendly. But he came into the county. He and his brother, they bought 200 acres, and James cleared enough of land to erect a small cabin. He cleared enough of land to plant some potatoes. He had carried some potatoes up some Indian trails, followed some creeks, and in this township, he planted some potatoes. Well, for the summer, he took off with a surveying company up to Erie County, and he was off the summer. In the fall, he came back to dig his potatoes. And when he gets back, imagine his shock to find that there's Indians living in his cabin. Well, these Indians were friendly. The house was empty. They thought the man must have died, so they took over. And they had dug and eaten his potatoes. Well, they opened their packs and they shared with him some of their furs and some of their meat that they had. So that didn't seem to cause too much trouble there. James Brawley left. The next spring, he came back with his mother and her family. And they came with a team of oxen and a wagon. I'm not sure how they did that through the forest on Indian trails. But they had some cows as well. They milked them and put the milk in the churn, which they had in the wagon. And the motion of the wagon churned the milk into butter as they came. Well, they ended up here in the township here, and they prepared to set up housekeeping. They arrived here with 25 cents. And with that 25 cents, they bought a quart of salt. All right, so that gives you a little bit of a picture of how people live. Salt. Salt. It gives you a little bit of picture of how people used to live differently. Okay, we're going to take a short break. For a break, we're going to take a brisk hike through the village of Guy's Mills. We'll go out the front door and head out down towards the store. We'd like to stop just beyond the store by the bridge. It goes across the stream down there. So we'll go down there, we'll hike around through Guy's Mills. We'll look at a few things in Guy's Mills, about the history of Guy's Mills, and we'll come back and get a drink, and we'll resume whenever we get here. Okay, let's take a hike down through Guy's Mills. First of all, as we get back into teaching history, how many of you enjoy history personally? Maybe I should rather ask, how many do not enjoy history? Okay, there's about three of them. I don't know what that's like. I enjoy history, especially church history. I drive by any church that says Mennonite Church right away. I'm wanting to go inside the church. I'm wanting to go inside. I'm wanting to see pictures of the people in the past and how they've changed over the years. And I don't. It's I want to know stories about people. So, how many of you enjoyed? Did you enjoy the story about Guy's Mills? Those of you who do not enjoy history, did you enjoy that story? I don't know who you were anymore, but okay. So, I'm assuming probably for you, if you don't enjoy history, it's probably going to be a little more difficult for you possibly to make it come alive for your students. It may take a little more effort, but then again, it may work the opposite. I'm interested in it, and yet I'm You know, yet for me to get my students interested in it is another thing. Well, what methods have we used in teaching history so far today?
Lecture?
Okay, that's one method. And right along with that, I think, especially with starting in fifth and sixth grade, your students need to be lectured to, and they need to be developing the art of note-taking. And my outline was designed with that in mind. Make an outline of your lecture, and then make an outline only partially filled in with your lecture, and let your students fill in to get the idea, the feel of what an outline feels like. Even fourth grade, they probably get into some of that, but get them some hands-on experience. In seventh and eighth grade, it's time to start requiring them to keep a notebook of taking notes in class, and then you collect the notebook and keep your notes, first of all, from your lectures, and then start your seventh and eighth graders, they should be graded on the notebooks that they're taking. It's difficult. It's a difficult job to grade their notebooks. But I'd try to give them maybe a test, same as a test grade for the quarter on their notebooks. Seems I was going to mention something else along that line, slipped my mind. But anyway, get them to take notes. What else have we used?
Visuals.
Pardon me?
I just said visuals.
Visuals? Okay, that's an important part of teaching almost any subject. They need to be able to visualize the subject, and we're going to talk about that a little more as we go along here, but they need to be able to visualize the subject. For instance, be sure to take notice of the pictures. Make mention and take notice of the pictures in the textbook so they can visualize the subject. It's difficult to learn if you can't visualize what you're supposed to learn. What else?
We have a thrift store nearby that has a lot of old National Geographic you can get cheap. Some of them have really good pictures of different places and how people live and so on.
Okay. We're going to talk about this more in detail. We might as well do it now. Calendar pictures. Teachers should not be throwing away calendars. You're talking about New England states and the calendar like this. We have the lifestyle or some of the economics of New England, of Maine. This is in Maine. And it just helps them to visualize it. Well, so that's the way their dads make a living. They get to go out in a boat. I wonder if I could go out in a boat with my dad if we lived there. I wonder if I could go to work with him. Fishing, and this is actually lobster boats. In the West, calendar pictures. It helps them to visualize the Badlands. They have a sizable picture they can view of it. Posters, whatever. Help them to visualize the subject and ask questions about the pictures. What do you think these children are all excited about? And discuss a bag of seeds? Is that exciting, a bag of seeds in a book? Well, yes, definitely. They don't live the way that you and I live. They don't have access to the seeds that you and I have. They don't have access to the literature you and I have. So be sure to note the charts and pictures in your books, in your text. They should definitely be something important. On your first day, take the textbook And cover. Ask questions about the cover, the pictures of the cover. Do you think that lady lives in this building here? Do you think she lives in that country? What do you think that is? What is that that she's carrying in her head? You see? What is that she's carrying in her head? She has one in her arm. Do you know? Cord. What do you think she's doing with that cord? What's it for? I don't know either, but what's it for? Okay? And leave some of your questions unanswered. Leave a little bit of a curiosity in the minds that you want to find out. These little shacks, sheds, or whatever they are down here, what do you think they're for? These little sheds. You know, some of them may not even have things cool. Some folks in the world may have been shacks like that. This girl with a smiling face, where do you think she lives? Okay? Get them interested in the book itself. You want them to be interested in history? Well, try to start out right in the first day. Get them interested in the book. Now, this is a good book. Some of you with your individualized curriculum are just kind of a draft back. But nevertheless, get them interested in the pictures. They should have pictures in the book, hopefully. Try and get them interested in the pictures in the book. Try and start the first day. Feel their curiosity. Make them curious. And if your book's not good, maybe you can develop something the first day, some poster, something, just to build their curiosity about social studies. Calendar pictures, encyclopedia. And I forgot to bring one. Show them the pictures in the encyclopedia. It's good for them to know that you're doing some study as well, without you telling them that. Draw maps. Have them draw maps. And you draw maps as well. And if you're first-year teachers, I know when I was a first-year teacher that I felt intimidated and I didn't want to be, you know, I didn't want to be laughed at and looked at funny. This kind of makes me nervous trying to do something up here even now when you are watching. But draw maps. Let's see, we have Lake Erie or something down here. I'm not sure if that's right. Maybe it's up here. And then we have along the border of the New England states. Now, that's not a very good map, but you can tell what it's supposed to be, can't you? I mean, don't be ashamed of your drawing. You can tell what it's supposed to be, and do it often, you'll get better at it. And it required students to, well, I'd say third and fourth grades, maybe they can trace maps, but fifth and sixth grade students should be drawing some maps. Get them to draw maps. Okay, I have some more on visuals, but I think we're going to go into something else first, and we'll come back to some of these visuals a little later. What else do we use so far today? Stories. History is stories. History is stories. Find them and tell them. Your textbooks oftentimes won't have the stories, and encyclopedias might have them. For instance, I think the one book we have, I remember teaching on the Swiss legend of hero is whom? William Tell. Do you know the story about William Tell? Okay. I kind of forgot that part. But at any rate, there was the king of the land got one of his servants, I think it was, to dig a pole and carry his hat on the pole and ride through town, and the people were supposed to do obeisance, bow down to the king's hat. But William Tell wouldn't do it. So they captured him. I didn't even read this book. They captured him, and he tells the rest of what happened. They were out in the boat, and anyway, well, that hat thing was interesting. Anyway, they were out in a boat, and he somehow got, I think he was out in the boat, I think that's the right story. He got free, but at any rate, I think it's coming back. The boat storm came up, he got free. They said he would, the king said, look, if you can shoot an apple off your son's head, we'll let you go. And he was a marksman, and he pulled the arrow and shot the apple off of his son's head. And then he turned around and said, but if I would have missed and killed my son, I would have turned and killed you as well. And that's when they captured him. They went off in a boat and a storm came up or something, and he got away free and delivered his people. That's a legendary hero. I'm not sure if that's exactly what took place, but that is the legend. Stories. And I had to go to the encyclopedia to find that. So well, there's people that are just mentioned by name in your history text. Go to the encyclopedia, look up the person's name, and find out something interesting about them. When you're studying the states, and when you come to Minnesota, they probably won't tell you that in the 1880s, I think it was, around 1883, they had a severe problem with grasshoppers. 1884, grasshoppers back again. 1885, 1886, they were getting worse. They were so bad that it clouded the sun from view. 1887, it looked like they were coming back again. And the governor of the state declared a national day of prayer and fasting. Well, so they had the day of prayer and fasting. Next day, a hot day. Millions of grasshoppers were hatching out of the eggs. It looks like everything's going to be destroyed. Second day, another hot day. Millions of grasshopper eggs hatching. Third night, a heavy frost killed off all the grasshoppers. That's a story. That's history. And yet you can use that to drive home a point. God answers prayer. And you're not going to find that in secular history books for sure. And a lot of these stories aren't in your history books. You need to find them. And what I have as an ideal, I said I'm an idealist, and I'm oftentimes a frustrated idealist. But I would encourage you to, anytime you come across a story in any periodical that you think is good for any reason, cut it out, save it, file it. And you'll have some stories at your fingertips for the right times. File them in specific categories so you can find them when you need them. You weren't supposed to ask that. Don't file the way I file. Subject is what I would tend to file by mostly. Prayer, mercy. I don't know exactly. But in my file, don't go by my filing. I'm just encouraging you to do. Right, right. That's the way I would tend to. I would encourage you to file some way that suits you better than the way that I do this. Does not suit me too well. I still have the goal and the ideal. Hopefully I'll get it perfected. Okay, anything else that we've used so far today? Discussion? We'll probably talk some about that some more, but well, maybe right now. Issues, especially 7th and 8th graders, bring in issues. What would you do in this situation? And younger students as well. But 7th and 8th graders, are we materialistic? Or how are we different than this man was acted? Okay, one other thing we did this afternoon yet. Already? Went on a hike. Okay, local history. Take some time to research your local history and maybe take a break for a week or at least one class period. You know, if it's not much history you can find, maybe just one class period. Skip the regular social studies and do have a little class on local history, or maybe a whole week, maybe 2 weeks if you have a lot to share. You don't want to focus so much on the broad picture that you forget to, you know, close home. Sometimes our history books are, when we focus on so much out there, And even sometimes we find ourselves in the studying the American Revolution and the Civil War. In April, we're studying the Civil War. And what about President Reagan and President Bush? You're not going to have time to hardly touch them. So, in other words, bring up, you do want to focus on where you are some as well, but don't forget where you are. That's part of the whole broad picture. Okay, let's have a real short history class here about India. Today I want to teach you some things about India. Today, history class will be about India. We're going to look first of all at some of the geographies. Off here to the east of India is the Bay of Bengal. Down here is the Indian Ocean, the Arabian Sea. You should know these facts. The Bay of Bengal, the Indian Ocean, the Arabian Sea. I'd like you to be able to put them on a map for me in a quiz sometime. Some of the neighbors of India, we have Pakistan over here. Pakistan and India, they don't get along too well. They're not very good neighbors. Up here we have China, communist country. They're probably not the best of neighbors either. Being China is communist and India is free. Down here we have Nepal. Here we have Bangladesh. Over on this side of India, India reaches over here. We have Myanmar over here. So those are some of India's neighbors. India's people, let's look at some Indian's people. 83% of the Indian people are Hindu. And the Hindus believe in reincarnation. That means if you die, when you die, that you're going to come back to life in some other form. They believe in reincarnation. Some of the rivers. I forgot. Okay, I jumped ahead of myself on the geography. But we'll finish up with the people first. So 83% of the Indians are Hindus. About 11% are Muslims. They don't get along too well with the Hindus. And there's about 3% that are Christians. Now, some of the history, the geography that we forgot, there are some important rivers in India. Three important rivers. Down through here runs the Ganges River. That's the most important river to India. We have over here the Brahmaputra River starts up here in China. Tributary to the Ganges River. Over on this side, we have the Indus River, which runs through India, but it leaves India and runs through Pakistan. That's another important river of India. There are several important cities in India. Bombay is the largest city in India, right down here along the coast. And if you're a history student or a current event student, you know that it's no longer called Bombay, it's called Mumbai, or something like that. Another important city is Calcutta, another huge city over here. And the capital of India is New Delhi, which is, the capital is New Delhi.
All right, for your assignment, read pages 46 to page 52 and do questions 1 through 10. All right, was that an interesting history class? You didn't enjoy that? Okay, let's try again.
Okay, today, lesson we're going to be learning about India. We want to learn some of the geographical features of India and some of the surroundings of India, On the east side, we have the Bay of Bengal. On the south, we have the Indian Ocean. On the west, we have the Arabian Sea. The seas are very important to India, to important India's weather. There are seasonal monsoons that about half the year, the winds are blowing in from the oceans, and as they blow over India, they drop rain. They bring lots of rain, producing a rainy season in India. And then in wintertime, there's an area of lower pressure out here, high pressure inland, and the winds reverse, and they blow out from the highlands of India, and they blow out across India, producing a dry season. So the seas are very important to India. It would be good if you would know the location of these seas, the Bay of Bengal, the Indian Ocean, the Arabian Sea. Let's say them together. Bay of Bengal, Indian Ocean, Arabian Sea. Let's say them backward.
Arabian Sea, Indian Ocean, Bay of Bengal.
Remember that the seas have very important effect on India's climate. They depend very heavily on the monsoon. And the thing about these monsoons, the seasonal rains that are caused by the wind flowing into the seas, weathermen are not able to exactly predict them. Like exactly, they may be late, they may be a few weeks late, they may be a few weeks early. And either way, it's going to cause hardship in India because the Indians depend very heavily on their farmers. However, there are some people that are fortunate enough to live along some important rivers in India. The Ganges River is a very important river in India. It's one of the largest rivers in the world. It runs through a large, flat plain. They say there are lots of farms, and they depend on the river for irrigation. And these folks will be a lot better off than those that are out here if the monsoons don't come in time. We have the Brahmaputra River. I have everything tied up here, well, I can do it here. For any of these new names, I'm demonstrating. All right, the Brahmaputra River runs right down through here. Brahmaputra. Let's say that together. Brahmaputra. All right, the Brahmaputra River is a tributary of the Ganges. These two rivers form a very fertile river valley, producing where lots of farm commodities are produced. Over in here, we have the Indus River that cuts just across India here, and it flows then over into Pakistan. Let's look at a few of India's neighbors. Pakistan is here on the west. Over here we have Bangladesh. These two countries here at one time were part of India, but most of the people living here were Muslims, and most of the people here were Muslims. Most of these people are Indians, Hindus. Now, when England gave them their independence in 1947, this caused a problem. Who's going to be in power, the Muslims or the Hindus? Well, England was wise enough to separate them and establish one nation of Pakistan, which was made up of Muslims. This made up West Pakistan, this made up East Pakistan. And the distance is so great between the nations, you can see it probably wouldn't work too well. And later, East Pakistan gained its independence from West Pakistan and became Bangladesh. Today we just call this Pakistan. Now, Pakistan and India, they still do not get along very well. These are mostly Muslims, these are mostly Hindus. And we have some skirmishes today up here in the Kashmir province, the most rugged country in the world, and they're fighting over it. This country's sending like 600 agents, undercover agents, to kind of infiltrate the area, and India responded by sending a bunch of jets and military equipment up here and
and start fighting with accent over the most rugged area in the world. Why do you think they did that? Why do you think they fight over their border like that?
Well, the border kind of identifies who you are, where you belong. And they both claim religion, but they're fighting over that. Okay, these are the most important of the Indian names you want to remember. Pakistan on the west and Bangladesh on the east. They once were part of India. All right, the Himalayas are an important mountain range to India. They're just up along the north part of India. They're the highest mountains in the world, but they also affect the temperature or the climate in India. Because of the tall mountains, the cold wintry blasts from up north in China and Russia, in the the cold frigid north of Russia, these mountains, Siberia, the cold winter blasts in Siberia are prevented from entering into India by this large mountain range. Highest mountain in the world is down in the Himalayas, Mount Everest.
Oh, that's right.
Over here.
Mount Everest
is actually in the border of Nepal and China. I don't think it actually borders India. But it's part of the Himalayan mountain ranges. Okay. The people of India. India has a total of 940 million people living in this country. There's a total of 940 million people living in this country. 83% of these are Hindus, 11% Muslim, and 3% Christian. That means about 910 million of these people are not Christians. There's at least 910 million people that are not Christians. How are they going to ever hear the gospel? Well, let's talk about their religion a little bit. The Hindus believe in, we talked about reincarnation already, but they also have a caste system where we have a top level of priests and warriors, and then next to them are maybe the bankers, that type of thing, the more educated people, and then we have another group of lower class people, and the lowest class people. There's four main castes. The lowest class, those are the ones that wash the windows and clean the bathrooms and that kind of thing. They're just at a menial task. And if you're born in one of these classes, you need to stay in that class whatsoever. You can't change. If you're born a bathroom cleaner, you can't become a banker. You can't become a priest. That's what you can be all your life, a bathroom cleaner. There might be some other jobs of that low nature you can do besides just cleaning bathrooms, but that's your lifestyle. You can't go from one class to another. Unless you die, then hopefully you've been good enough that you can come back as a higher class person. You see how much these people behind the law, they're trying as hard as they can to be as good as they can to come back as a better person. Well, how do you think you would relate to that if you were a missionary to India? What should you do? The nation has outlawed the caste system. When you get out into the villages, they still operate on that system. Most people in India still have that in the back of their mind. That's where they operate. How are you going to relate to that as a missionary? Do you have to have a separate church for the ones in low class, high class? It may depend on how you feel about it here at home. Do you have separate churches for blacks and whites? Some of these issues you need to face as being a missionary to India. You may need to decide which people you want to be a missionary to, because the priests will not associate with the low class. Okay, aren't you glad we have a much better religion? We have something to offer. But there's 910 million people in India that. Okay? Well, what would they have to look for? Does anybody have an idea? I think it's called Nirvana or something like that, where you have, if you have been good enough, you can reach a state of the gods where you just exist as in a state of well-being. You can forget about ever coming back again. You're well off now. So if you're in the highest class, you're still looking forward to become part of the gods.
The cows come into it.
Well, if you were a bad person in your life as a fashion creator, you would cheat it and you don't come. You may come back as a cow. Therefore, I will not butcher my cow, neither should anybody else butcher my cow, because it might be my grandma. And she may have been, according to this caste system, there's very little meat eaten in India. Even the rats. I understand that if, well, at one point, the government did have to take control and kill the rats because they would not kill the rats. And rats were getting a grain and people were having a famine, yet they wouldn't kill the rats because it may have been my great-grandfather. It's hard to imagine how a person could believe that strongly. I mean, these cows that are wandering around in the streets of Bombay could provide lots of meat for these people. Okay, the cows are considered sacred, and I'm not sure why that would be. Would you want to look into that for us and tell us about it tomorrow? It's better to do that than say, I'll look into it, because if I say I'll look into it, I probably won't. And the students will probably forget to ask the question, and it'll be forgotten. Okay, some of these, we should maybe look at some of these cities. Bombay is the largest city in India. 12.5 million people. I intend to have an encyclopedia up here to show you a picture of Bombay and show you what they were doing and where they lived there. 12.5 million people, most of them never having heard, probably never having heard the name of Jesus. Do you think that hurts God's heart? Do you think that makes God sad? It should make us sad as well. All right, New Delhi is the capital. And we have Calcutta, another important city with 10 million people living there as well. All right, was that any more interesting? I know it may not have been interesting, but was it more interesting than the first try? So, what were some things that we try to do in this session? What were some things that we try to do to try and get some of the lessons across, some of the history across? Involve the class. Good.
Repetition.
Okay, relationships. You want your students to be able to connect how that this incident or this region affects another region. And we can do a lot more of that in social studies. What else? Adding details that are not necessarily in the textbook, such as?
I don't know what was in the textbook.
Okay.
Just interesting comments that you made that
Right. Right. Okay. Like the population, I had to read in several textbooks to come up with population, that type of thing. Oftentimes, that's where books like this come in handy. You should have a book like this in your school. If you don't, get one yourself. The World Almanac, you can find lots of details about certain nations or states that you might not find in your text. And it's going to just add a little bit of flavor to your class, to add a little bit of things that's not in your textbook. The thing that makes history boring at times is you're telling them exactly what they read in the textbook. I find I tended to do that a lot already. And that it doesn't keep their interest. They already know it. They've already read it. Or they know that they will read it.
I have a question as far as how much, beginning of last year, I would kind of assign my students to read certain pages and I can talk about it. And I discovered that they weren't either some of them weren't reading it. And toward the end of the year, I finally quit assigning them to read that, at least very so. Maybe I tell them a short portion of it, but instead of that, I just read it with them and discuss it as we went along, because unless I did it, some of them just didn't have much of a clue what was there.
Okay, that's a good point. For, I would say, fourth and fifth graders, and depending on the aptitude of your students, maybe even higher than that. I've done that already in different classes where I'd take the text and read it with the students. I think that's good. What I find sometimes is students are not reading the text. They're reading the questions and going back and trying to find the answers without reading the text. And that's frustrating to me as well as to them. But yes, I think it's good to read the text with them at least several class periods, and it may help to get them to do it on their own. Question? Right. What I generally like to do is maybe pick out a few points that I know are in the lesson and comment on them to give them a little something to look for as they read. I try to do that at times. I do that at times. But yeah, in lower grades, it's very appropriate to read with them in their text. But don't forget to bring in some things that are going to spark their interest. I think some of the times the reason they don't apply themselves is because they're not interested in the subject.
Sometimes getting down to the paper.
A lot of that is oftentimes in the text. Just take time to pull it out of the text. Look, the pictures. Again, I'm saying the pictures. Refer to the pictures, the captions, and talk about the pictures that are there. Why are they wearing those things? Or why does he wear that funny thing on his head? And it just kind of helps them to see, well, look, these people are different. There's something unique here. Okay, what else have we used? Maybe there's another question. What else have we used so far this afternoon? What do you do when you come up here and you thought you were a city wise and you can't find it?
It's still frustrating too because they're right up here, it's fine.
What do you do?
And two people have a race to find it.
Okay. Rather than just get red in the ears and get frustrated, yeah, have someone come up to help find it. Okay, then we'll move on. Okay, we were doing a little map practice here. If you're teaching grades 1 and 2, someone has noted it's important to that your students, first and second graders, or by second grade, they already know the continents, memorize the continents. Well, this map, I don't like it. But we'll go through it anyways. I'll go through the continents, and then I want you to repeat them with me after we go through them. North America, South America, Europe, Asia, Africa, Australia, Antarctica. All right, you say them with me. North America, South America, Europe, Asia, Africa, Australia, and Antarctica. All right, for first and second grade especially, and probably for any grade on any state or any region, always start at the same place and get them to go around in that order. I mean, I'm not saying it has to be that order, but the same order. Get an order and stick with your order.
for first and second graders. They will, sometimes you may then drill. Let's drill these continents. Just say them. All right. If your students in first and second grade get mixed up, you'll find them stopping and they'll go through them in the order that they memorize them, and they'll figure out which one it is. So start that order, and I feel that it's good to start right here. This is where they live. Always start with something they can associate with. That's not the word I want, but something they can relate to. Always start with something they can relate to. Okay. This can come down. It's been done with it. Okay, we wonder how long it takes. Let's practice with the steaks a little bit. We're learning the New England steaks. Let's start with either Massachusetts or Maine. Maine is the largest one, or maybe Massachusetts because it's got the little tail out there. But we'll start with Maine. Up here we have Maine. Then we have New Hampshire and Vermont. Say them with me. Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont. Again, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont. And older students can take one, about six or seven. And get them, just do it. And do it. And then, in the same class period, mix them up. And all of these in New England. All right, call them out. Okay, we didn't learn these, so we'll learn them first. All right. Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island. Say them with me. Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island. All right, just call out the states. All right. Now, another thing students enjoy, and I'm going to, how many of you play around the world? You know what I mean by that? Okay, let's have maybe the girl on the end stand behind the girl next to you. And I'm going to point to any state up here, and the first one to say it gets up and moves on. All right, any state?
Kentucky.
All right, so whoever got it gets up and goes to the next person. Let's do this again. Try not to tell your students where you're going to point. All right. All right. You can. You got it. Okay. So you would have moved on. Let's do a few more down the line here like that. All right. Next state. Just tap the person behind you. Did you say it? Missouri. That's what they try to do. What students do? They try to. See what the word is.
The person that's standing there gets a pick. We stand
behind. No. You go down the row. Exactly. Okay, so who said Missouri? Okay, so she gets up and goes to the next person, and you, so seeing the girl standing, sits down. So you get up. Sorry, I don't have your name. And stand behind the next person. You just go down your aisle. Like that. The students try to stay up the longest. They want to be up, and it becomes a race between the two eventually. It becomes a race between the two or three best, and they try to get them down. And then it becomes kind of ineffective to use this game, and you need to go into something else, possibly. But another state. Minnesota. Okay, so she gets up. The one that got the answer gets up and goes on to the next person. And she's going to try to stay up as long as she can. Okay?
Virginia.
Next question? Nebraska's right. Okay, you know how to go back here by seats. But go down the line, they enjoy games like that. You can do that with questions like, who was the first president? And they just have them stand beside their your desk. You don't want to overdo this one because if you have a large class, some of them won't be listening until it's their turn. So it's just to break the monotony if you have a large class, but they do enjoy it. And it gives them something to work for. I mean, they want to stay up the longest. Okay. States and capitals. They should know. Let's go through the states and capitals. Oh, come on. Teachers shouldn't be sighing about that. Okay, give me the capital. Wait, it's for the next one.
Charleston.
Atlanta?
Atlanta.
Tallahassee. Capital of.
Trust me, Georgia's Atlanta.
The capital of Georgia, I think, is.
Tallahassee. I think our textbook says Atlanta.
The thing is, I was making these last night at 1 o'clock, or this morning, 1 o'clock, and I was we'll just put that up.
Tallahassee is Florida.
All right, if you didn't like it, if you don't like that, how about my wife waiting for me? All right. What do you do when you made a mistake?
Admit it. Are you going to accept those kind of excuses from your students? You know, you won't accept them saying, well, my brother lost my paper. My brother did this. Or my dad said I can't finish it. You don't accept excuses from them. Don't try and make excuses for yourself.
Take responsibility. You are responsible for your own actions. And if they can see that, that's going to mean something to them. They see it. You take responsibility for what you do. Don't try and tell them you're up to be out of the morning. Don't tell them that somebody else is at fault. And the reason I bring this in is because if you, history of the classroom can happen. Is you have some students that are really interested in history. I have one. It seemed like he must have read the encyclopedias. True. And there's going to be times when they're going to know more than the teacher does. And there's going to be times they're going to have to correct you. Back here. Thank you. I was wrong. Okay. Now, the states. When your students are kind of uncertain, going through this, they're kind of shake up. Be sure to say loud up. They all can hear. Concord is the capital of New Hampshire. Okay. And you do the same thing with them, playing games with them. Let's just make a word, travel around the world, and kind of teach you that game. And don't do it long, maybe just a few minutes. You don't have a lot of time to teach you 2 or 3 grades. So do something every class period. Repetition is one of the things that you're going to have to use in history to really get these things across. All right, so states and capitals. We've been doing some of these states. Let's go through the states here and just call out the states. All right, let's go through and do the capitals. All right, the capitals. Montpelier is correct. Concord. Hartford. All right, so different things you can do. Just reinforce it, and don't always just go through the
states and have them the capitals. Switch them around and go to the map and call, point to the states, let them call out the capitals. Okay. Keep up with, you don't want to omit current history. Bring in newspaper, interesting newspaper or the headlines in the papers. Bring those in sometimes. Make a bulletin board with them. I just hurriedly put this together. But you want to make an attractive bulletin board, arrange it, and maybe have a title for it. Does anybody have any problems with this? With this display? Well, we have up here Hillary traces husband development to childhood. That makes a good lesson. That's what we often want to do. Here we have an adult that's trying to blame what they're doing. Blame their failures on what happened to the job. Oh, the proposed tax cut for Americans. Is that a good idea?
That's
what I'm thinking too. Is the debt. We have the nation is nearly in debt by both at $15 trillion. And all it is a political game. It's a political game. What is it? All right. Questions mount. Will Bush maintain the lead? Try to predict the future based on what's happened in the past, based on what we see happening. What do you think? Do you think Bush will be elected? Do you think Howard Bush will be elected? Why?
He's always reacting to the
But it's good to just, think. Why might somebody else be? Why might we get a new president rather than the one we have? Or rather than the vice president. How about this one, Big Mac? What is that referring to? Big Mac? McDonald's? Markiplier. Is it good to ask about this from the... Well, first of all, who's Markiplier? I think we should be careful. I think we should be annoying some of these things. But if you know that your students are obsessed with sports, I don't think it's a good idea to have that athletic. I think it's good to be able to look at what's happening. It's part of the news, it's part of what's happening in the world. Go ahead and look at some of those things. But stay current with your students. Read to them newspaper articles. Well, I'm thinking 7th and 8th grade, possibly. 1st and 2nd graders, you would not want to read a newspaper article to 1st and 2nd graders, I don't think. 6th grade, something that they know has happened has been interesting in the past. Okay, maybe we'll try. You use lots of games. Students generally like to play baseball. And I'm not sure whether it's a good place to try this thing, but let's have, I like a bunch of volunteers play baseball.
All right, raise your hand high. If you're a volunteer, line up here. We need 9 of you to line up here. I need 9 of you to line up against it. This one. You line up next time, Paul. But today, it may work in your classroom depending on how well you do. I'm going to ask you a question. If anybody over here gets it first, you're out.
Can any of us answer?
No, just sit in the back.
Can any of us answer?
Yes, any of you can answer. You're the viewers. But generally, generally you give them at least 3 seconds to answer and then turn it to the viewers. Well, one of you had it right. One of you fumbled. I'll give you first base questions unless you request a home run question. Egyptian writing was called?
Hieroglyphics.
Hieroglyphics, that's 1 hour.
Are we supposed to wait till you say for us to answer?
No, today we'll just get you jumped in. Okay. Just to demonstrate what we're doing. Champollion discovered a stone with many.
Okay.
Yes, they should have waited until the question about it. I'll do it this way. When my hand comes down, you're free to answer. Alright? The Sumerian writing was called. Okay, nobody knows? Sumer, the writing there, cuneiform. Generally, what I do is call a stripe. Nobody looks for another chance. Stripe one. The year 612 BC, what took place? What city fell? Okay, that's right, too. This is the next one for you. The famous Greek poet was
Homer.
All right, good job. Okay, so now that's all right. Well, next batter is next question. The famous Greek god was Zeus. All Right. So yeah. Okay. Now they're up in that. And there's first, second, third. Okay.
You can
say. My name comes down to the answer. Everyone over here. Who brought democracy to Greece? Paraphrase. I should have Henry.
Okay,
that's step one. The rich politicians of Rome were called. Alright, this might be easier. Who blamed the Christians for burning Rome?
Nero.
Alright, we get to the first page.
Alright, where's the first page?
Okay, who legalized Christianity in the Roman Empire?
Constantine.
Alright, one out. Next. Who was a prophet and founder of Islam?
Mohammed.
All right. The God of Islam is the religion. Islam is
Allah.
Allah. Good.
Go to first page.
Jesus. Yeah. All right. The Lollards were followers of a religious teacher called
the what?
The Lollards. And followers and religious teachers and followers of John Whitehead. Okay, strike one. All right, this one will be easy. The ship that brought the pilgrims to America was. All right, base is loaded with 2 hours. Okay, that's all my questions except for some home run questions. I don't know if we're going to use them or not.
Yeah, we got a grand slam here.
Okay. The builder of the Tower. Yeah, the builder of the Tower of Babel. Okay, strike one.
Who
was it? Nimrod. Okay, we talked about cuneiform writing. The Assyrian king, named the Assyrian king who collected 100,000 tablets, clay tablets of cuneiform writing. Yeah, that was difficult. Ashurbanipal in his name. Strike two. Okay, name the important battle that took place 732 AD. Okay, those were harder. That's why I call them home run questions. That is strike three, you're out. Okay, you can go back. Does it make sense how it works?
Yeah.
Okay. I like that for review. It gives them something different. I mean, it's a lot more enjoyable to do something like that for a whole class period. And you can make up other games. You know, that was basically a made-up game. I never played that one in class like we did here, but a teacher gave me that idea. I did it, though, on the board with the baseball diamond and kind of went around like that. But it's something different. I mean, it's different than history. It's playing a game, but it's still reviewing what they know. Another one I used to like to do is it takes time to come up with some of these things. But what do you call the thing where you have, you guess the letters, there's the blocks, there's some work, there's a letter there.
Is it
like, yeah, something like that. But what I do is, I've already done this in Egypt. The Gift of the Nile was the title of the chapter. And I did that Egypt, the Gift of the Nile. And I assigned certain points to each one of these blocks, maybe 1 point or something. And if someone gets that, they got the whole word, they get an extra point.
But what I have is, I come up with questions, and this is where it becomes difficult. You come up with questions, and the answers begin with that letter. And then maybe the answer to the question that we want to get in here, you would have a question like, the Orchard River in Palestine, and then even in Palestine, along which trade, important trade route brought traders into Egypt. Which important river we're talking about? Anybody?
Euphrates.
So we have E, Euphrates.
And I guess the word that
means now. Well, no. If they think they know the word, okay, what I do then, being these are questions that they should all know. I like to have two teams. They got this one, so I'll let them get another chance. They go on to get another one. They choose which of these blocks, I think I have a number, they choose which one they want to guess. And then I read the question, I have a number accordingly. So then they choose this one over here. And you ask them another question, and if they get it, then they got two of them. But then, being they should know them all anyways, I'll go to the next team. If they did get this one, well, they don't get a second one. And then, once they think they know the word, then I may let them go ahead and give them all the questions for that word. They have to still come up with the answers. In order to, they can't just guess the word. They know, in other words, they know what the word starts with. They get them, you know, that helps them out there.
But they get to know until they miss them.
You decide. I mean, this was a made-up game for me. It was, you know, use some creativity. It takes time to do this. It's sometimes you wonder if it's worth the time. But they enjoy it. So try and come up with games. Something that's going to be a little different from the routine. One thing I do want to caution against, and that is, say, from grades 1 to 4 and 5, don't play so many games. Don't create a party spirit in your classroom. Because I don't think the upper grades are going to find that. I've had students coming, and this is no reflection against the teacher. I don't think any of you know who it was, but I had students coming from another teacher that, you know, they had lots of their classes, just lots of party time, and it was fun school. But when they came to seventh and eighth grade, sixth grade, upper grade room, they did not. I mean, it was a hard time for them to adjust to disciplining themselves to study. And we did some games, we did some fun things, but we didn't have a party time. And I know that some of the same students that had a difficult time adjusting, you know, they really, after they'd been in my room for 3 years, they enjoyed being there, and some of them hated the change. But try not to develop too much of a party spirit. School is work, and you want your students to know that as well. But you do want them to enjoy it. You do want to have enough of things to keep it alive. Okay, a few things we should look at yet. Oh, okay, back to current events. I forgot one thing. It's not that important because it's out of date anyway. I wish I had something to recommend to you to keep up with current events. There had been a world news map that was excellent. You went over that every week. This was more for fifth to eighth graders, but they enjoyed that.
There is something from Bob Johnson. We're going to order those.
Okay. I know that where we were getting them from, they told us of another option, and we weren't pleased with that option. It wasn't, but I'm not familiar with Bob Jones. But yeah, if you can find a world news map that comes out every 2 weeks or something, it's just something that keeps them up to date. I think our people, our children ought to know what's happening in the world. So if you don't have any of those things, at least read the newspaper yourself. Once or twice a week, or a news magazine once a week or something. Kind of know what's happening in the world. And let your children know, so that you know that when you're Recently, Taiwan and China were having a war, a propaganda war, on the wording of the status of the nations. Back in the prior to World War, well, I don't even have a date, so I'm just doing this off the top of my head, but the revolution in China, when the communists came in and took over, there was a strong nationalist army that was trying to keep the communists out, but they were losing, they were losing. They finally had to flee across to Taiwan, and that's where the free Chinese moved to, and the rest of China became communist. And this island was part of China. Well, the free communists now live there, and they have a free government, while the rest of China is communist. But it's still one China. And both these nations, both Taiwan and China, have insisted that there's one China. Communist China insists that eventually they must be reunited as one country in unity. Or as Taiwan says, there's one China, eventually we must be reunited in democracy. Well, just recently, the president of Taiwan says, it's time that we are recognized as an individual state. We're going to have to be related to as a state. And that infuriated the communist Chinese, and it was getting rather exciting to the people living in those regions. But those things come up in the newspaper, and no, I'm not teaching that right now, but I'll bring it in anyways. And then when we get to that part, there'll be something, you'll bring in some of the history, and there'll be something there that's going to be reinforced when you do get there. Or maybe you studied it last year. It's going to reinforce some of the things they learned last year. Okay, just a few things yet. If you're teaching a fundamentalist book, you're probably going to run into patriotism. How do you counter that? You know, let me read you an example, for instance. Stonewall Jackson, well, let's start with Robert E. Lee. Whenever Robert E. Lee had a decision to make, he first asked himself, what is my duty as a gentleman and a Christian? Who was Robert E. Lee?
Leader of the South.
Leader of the South, great general of the South. Stonewall Jackson, one of the greatest military heroes of the Civil War and one of the greatest generals of all times was Thomas Stonewall Jackson, who fought under Robert E. Lee. Jackson earned the nickname of Stonewall at the Battle of Bull Run, where he and his soldiers fought against overwhelming odds. Another Confederate general, seeing Jackson's great courage, shouted to his own men, "There is Jackson, standing like a stone wall. Let us determine to die here, and we will conquer." Stonewall Jackson had an outstanding Christian testimony that he shared with his men under him and around him. Church services were held in his tent whenever possible, and he handed out gospel tracts to his troops and encouraged them to pray and read their Bibles faithfully. Before the war, he taught a Sunday school class for black slaves, and during the war, he continued to send money for the support of his class. How do you relate to that? Well, one thing I like to do is find stories. For that particular instance, I found a story in Pathways book about a boy living in the Shenandoah Valley, and the South came after him to draft him, and he hid out in the mountains. Eventually took off to the north where he wouldn't be drafted. I think they had CO status there, and portray him as a hero. And one thing you do want to remember, that patriotism is noble. Don't try to undermine patriotism. It's a noble thing to die for your country. But we do have a higher, our calling is a higher calling. It's more noble to die for Jesus Christ. Nathan Hale, he made that famous comment, "I only regret that I have but one life to give for my country." Well, we can turn that into our statement. Where is our country? What is my country? My country is a heavenly country. I only regret that I have one life to lose for Jesus Christ. Do you want to hear a story? I mean, our time's up. I could read one about somebody relating to George Washington. Are you ready to go?
Now, you mean in that book
right here? It's in the other book right here.
Okay. Are those available?
Yes. Pathway Publishing. And there's, again, keep track of stories that you read in art and periodicals and use them. I forgot to mention a few things. You can feel free to take a look at. Visualizing. This is something I did in school when we were going through the states. I don't recall. I knew I drew some of these states. I don't know if I drew them all. But you draw a state or trace it. I'm not sure whether it's going to draw. And then they have the state name, state abbreviation model, the state bird, the state flower, state trees. This is one of my prizes in school. And it's good to do. This is what we did in school. Our task, it was one of my worst nightmares, God, I would say. We have a lot of classes plus art show. What do you do for art? Well, do something related to your other subjects. Paper mache. Who did this? They love it. You build up your map. And it teaches them elevation. It teaches them what should look like. It teaches them the camera. So this can be kind of interesting after all. They all enjoyed doing this. They didn't enjoy studying the maps, but they all enjoyed this. Painting it. History. One thing we did when I was in school, this is another one of my school papers, Children of Many Lands, they have a picture of Ramana Peru, they put the picture, they colored it, and then they copy a story on the back side about that individual. Penmanship. If you can't find time, penmanship, something like that. And I also have these available if you don't have access to those. That you could make some copies of those. Okay, the last point yet. Focus, how can I maintain the focus on Christ or on the fear of the Lord? And I was trying to do that all afternoon, but maybe we could note some of the quotes yet on your papers. Some of those are profound. I don't have my copy here. There's some extras here.
Just read over those quotes on the next page. They are they kind of relate to the focus. There's some things you want to bring out. Maybe another last paragraph there. Why Paul Revere is so important. He wasn't even the one who was chosen to take the message. Paul Revere was the one who was supposed to go after in case he first got his call. You want to bring out the broader picture, what your textbook might not be telling you. We've been focusing on that all afternoon.
Focus on the sovereignty of God. How did God take care of his people through this? How is God working for his people through this incident? Focus on some of these things. So the focus here on the end, I hope we were focusing on that all afternoon. We want to aid in raising up children that are going to fear the Lord, that are going to be willing to serve Christ with all their hearts. Any questions that you want to talk about yet before we quit? It's time to quit.
I just
noticed that if you had to pick a country that maybe they wanted to be a missionary in, they got really interested in finding out about it. Good. Okay, well, thank you for your attention, and I hope you have a successful
year in teaching history. For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.